her pouring forth from stillness. So tonight we enter the western quarter of the mandala. We approach Amitabha's realm. And as we enter the western quarter, the day is drawing to a close. Evening's come upon us. Our day's work has been accomplished. We leave aside the physical activity of the day. But it's not time to retire yet. We can't go to our beds yet. There's still work to be done as the day slips into night. And as the day slips into night, we turn our attention inwards. The magnificent golden sun of the day has turned to a warm, rich red, and it's gradually sinking down behind the horizon, tinting the blue sky with a wonderful array of yellows, orange, and reds. Stretching out before us as far as our eye can see, or if we use our imagination, as far as our mind can conceive, is a vast expanse of blue-green ocean. The ocean waters are very calm and still. Small waves, gently undulating, break the surface of the water from time to time. The light from the sun casts a pathway of glistening, sparkling golden light that shimmers out across the ocean. Just above the water, resting on the golden pathway, is an immense, many-petaled, magnificent, deep, rich red lotus flower. It's a splendid lotus throne. Supporting the lotus throne are four birds, four peacocks, displaying their majestic green, blue, and golden eyed plumage. Upon the lotus throne there rests a pristine, pure, unsoiled, unsullied, brilliant white moon mat. And seated upon the moon mat, upon his red lotus throne, is a sight so wonderful, so beautiful, so lovely, so magnificent, that it takes our breath away. Seated before us is the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, the Buddha of love and compassion, the King of the deathless Samadhi, the Lord of discriminating wisdom. He has the colour of rubies, a deep, warm, rich, vibrant jewel-like red that glows and vibrates. It's an alluring, attractive, inviting red. It draws our attention. Adorning his body are robes made from the finest silks, orange and red, and finely embroidered with small golden lotuses that sparkle and glisten in the light. Amitabha has a handsome face, with curly blue-black hair tied in the top knot. He has long Shakyan ears. His eyes are wide open, sparkling and beautiful, a brilliant blue, the colour of the Indian Ocean. Upon his lips he has a delightful, compassionate smile. Amitabha is seated in full lotus posture. His hands rest in his lap, holding the dhyana, or meditation mudra. One hand rests upon the other, with the thumbs lightly touching, the space between his fingers and thumbs forming a perfect oval. There he sits, perfectly still, absorbed in profound samadhi, unmovable like a mountain. Nothing disturbs his mind, nothing ruffles his concentration. He dwells in the bliss and stillness of meditation, solid as a rock, yet completely at ease, graceful, poised and elegant. In the centre of Amitabha's chest is the seed syllable Hri, warm and red, glowing, pulsating and dancing like the flames of a fire. All around us resonates the sound of Amitabha's mantra, a continual sounding throughout the universe. Om Amideva Hri. Om Amideva Hri. Om Amideva Hri. Just as the sound resonates everywhere, and just as the setting sun radiates light, a warm ruby-red light radiates out from Amitabha. It's the warm light of love and compassion, an infinite, immeasurable light, boundless, continuous, pouring forth, overflowing outwards through all of space. Amitabha is an inexhaustible beacon, glowing with love for every sentient creature. As we sit and bask in the warmth of the setting sun, so we can sit and bask in the compassionate light of Amitabha and allow ourselves to be completely suffused in his love. So now that we've invoked Amitabha, and in a sense he's appeared before us, we've got a sense of what he looks like and some of his characteristics and qualities. For the rest of the talk, I want to draw out and expand upon a number of these symbols and qualities. So I'm going to particularly look at the colour red, at light, at love and compassion, at the lotus flower, at wisdom, and concluding with meditation. So the colour red. Well, as we know, Amitabha is a deep, rich, ruby red, and red is quite a common colour. Apparently it's the first colour that infants notice when they discern colour, which is probably not surprising since they spend 9 months in a very red environment. And there's a large spectrum of reds. It's a common colour. You can look around, there's quite a lot of red in this room, particularly a lot because of the cushions and things. But generally, if you look around, there's a lot of red around you. It's a common colour. And you get quite a spectrum from quite dark reds, like a cherry, for example, right through to a pinky red, like a radish. So it's a common colour. But Amitabha is not an ordinary red. He's a particularly striking ruby red. I hadn't actually seen a ruby until quite recently, and I'm very fond of red. Red is my favourite colour, and I have quite a lot of red things. But it was only quite recently that I saw what ruby red is really like, and I was particularly taken by it and struck by how wonderful ruby red is. And this partly reflects what rubies are like themselves. Rubies are the most precious of all the gemstones. Apparently they're rarer and more precious or more expensive than diamonds are, which is something I didn't know. They're very rare indeed, particularly good rubies are very hard to find. And in Sanskrit, the ruby is known as the Ratnaraja, the king of jewels. And the word itself, red, well, the red word red itself derives from the word ruby. It comes from the Latin for ruby, which is ruba. So in a way, ruby red is the quintessential red. It's how all other reds are marked against. So Amitabha is the quintessential red. So it's a very rich, warm red that almost glows. It sort of vibrates and almost pulsates. And rubies are sometimes referred to as glowing coals. It's almost as if they're alive and glowing. But it's almost quite luminous and translucent. If you pass light through a ruby, it makes things go very red. You sort of get this sense of redness. And this reminded me of a photographic darkroom. I don't know if any of you have been in a darkroom, but they have red lights. You use a red light in the photographic darkroom to see. And if you've ever been in one, it is as if you are in red. The whole place is suffused with this this redness. And I can't imagine that with other colours. I can't imagine, for example, being in a blue room. But I can get a sense of what it's like to be in a red room and to be in redness. So this is the first quality of red, if you like. It's very deep, it's very warm. But red's also a very alluring colour. It's a very inviting and attractive colour. It's a colour that draws our eyes, and it engages our attention. And red has a quality of fascination. It's very difficult to ignore red. You're very much drawn towards it. So what are some of the common associations with red? The first one is, well, one that strikes you quite obviously is that blood is red. Blood, which as my biology teaches to say, is the stream of life. Blood is vital to our life, and it sort of courses around our body, transporting all these nutrients and oxygen and so forth. And blood is very much associated with vitality, with the body, with life. But red is also very much associated with the emotions. And again, they're quite warm, hot emotions. When we get angry, we say we see red. And in fact, our face can become quite red when we get angry. When we get embarrassed, we flush pink. Passion is also associated with red, and it's another fiery emotion. But most of all, what's associated with red is love. The red heart is the most common symbol of love, along with red flowers, usually red roses. And you can easily see the correspondence here with attraction, with fascination, with warmth, with engagement, because this is what we feel when we fall in love. Someone else becomes very attractive, very inviting, very alluring, and we're certainly drawn towards them. And also when we fall in love, we get very aroused. We're very awake and we're very alive. And red is the colour of emotional arousal. And as we know, romantic love can be incredibly energising. We suddenly find ourselves full of life, we're bouncing with energy, we're inquisitive, we're fascinated with the world around us. Suddenly birds sing very tunefully, flowers bloom very vividly, the sun shines even when it's raining, babies become very cute and cuddly, even kissable, and we skip around with childlike glee, apparently without a care in the world. So the heart is a seat of our emotions, and our emotions give us life and energy. And the heart is full of red blood, which literally pumps around our bodies, but it also pumps emotional energy around our spirits. So just in case we're getting a little carried away with the warmth and the passionate fire of red and the surge of emotions, it's also good to remember that red is associated with danger and alarm. Warning and hazard signs are often red. Fire is red, fire engines are red, and in Christian iconography, the hells and the devil himself are red. Red then also signifies stopping, danger, taking care and caution, which incidentally is an association that lovers all too easily miss. So these are some of the mundane associations with red. Amitabha, however, is nothing but mundane. He's a fully, perfectly enlightened Buddha. In fact, he's the personification of transcendental wisdom in his dynamic aspect, which is compassion. The red of Amitabha is very much associated with warmth, with love, and the emotions, and he's a very attractive figure. He's very alluring, he's inviting, and he's fascinating. This partly accounts for Amitabha's popularity. He's the most popular of all the Jinnas, and in fact he's the only Buddha to have a tradition dedicated completely to him, which is the Pure Land tradition, and he has millions of devotees in Japan and East Asia. His colour certainly draws one to him. So the love that Amitabha represents is not the mundane love that we're familiar with. Amitabha's love is completely unconditional. Unlike romantic love, Amitabha's transcendental love is freely given and expressed. There are no conditions attached. There are no ifs, there are no buts, there are no maybes, there are no exclusions. Our romantic love, however, is quite fickle and particular. When our lover pleases and delights us, our love soars high in the sky, burning brightly. When our lover displeases us, it crashes down around us, smokes in a corner. Amitabha's love burns bright at all times. It's infinite, it's immeasurable, it's boundless, and it pours forth for every single sentient creature. So the analogy of light. I think the use of the analogy of light for Amitabha is a fantastic one. He's the Buddha of infinite light. I hadn't really given this much thought before, but light's quite a curious phenomenon. As long as it has a source, and as long as it's burning, it completely fills space, assuming, of course, it's not obstructed. And where would we be without light? We can see nothing in darkness, but we see everything in light. Light is elusive, too. You can't really touch it, you can't grab hold of it, but yet it's always around us. Amitabha's light this warm, rich red, inviting light of compassion that radiates out, fills the whole of space, which in the mandala is infinite. Amitabha's love and compassion fills the whole of space, it's everywhere, and it's also inexhaustible. Unlike the sun itself, which provides light for us, the sun will eventually consume itself. Amitabha's radiant light shines forth infinitely and eternally. So what are love and compassion? Again, love is a very familiar word. It's in very common currency. We use the word quite a lot. It's quite a heavy word, but it's quite lightly thrown. What do we mean when we say love? What are we referring to when we talk about love? Well, we refer to different things as there are different types of love. There's love of our parents, love for children, love for our siblings, love for our friends, love for ourselves, love for higher values, love for life. According to the ancient Greeks, love takes different forms. Love can be unselfish, love can be possessive, love can be practical, love can be playful, and love can be erotic. But what about spiritual love? What about love in the spiritual or the transcendental sense? Well, in Buddhism there are three types of love that flows in three directions. Firstly, there is love for those who are above us, that is, those who are more developed, and this flows upwards in the form of reverence or devotion. Then there's love for our peers or our contemporaries, and this flows out horizontally in the form of metta. And then there's love for those who are below us, as it were, those who suffer, and this flows downwards in the form of compassion. So the clearest expression of love in the spiritual sense, I think, is manifest in the positive dimension of the first ethical precept, which is, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. In the 10 Pillars of Buddhism, Sangharakshita explores the nature of love with a quote from Shelley, which Dharmasiddhi quoted in his talk. But I'm going to quote it again because it's very good in encapsulating love. The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A man to be greatly good must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. Bhante defines love in the following way himself. Love, which is the form of the first precept, is no mere flabby sentiment, but the vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with all other living beings. Love represents absolute affirmation. As such, is not erotic love, or parental love, or even friendly love. It is a cherishing, protecting, maturing love, which has the same effect on the spiritual being of others as the light and heat of the sun have on their physical being. Love then involves identifying with others. It involves awareness and receptivity, going beyond oneself and going towards others with kindness, friendliness, understanding, empathy, and above all, a desire for their spiritual welfare. Amitabha is completely receptive. His response is always kindness, always love, always a desire to help others. He continually responds to the cries of the world, the suffering of all beings, and he responds with compassion. So compassion is also a familiar word, a common word. It's a very common word in Buddhism, especially in Mahayana Buddhism. But what is compassion? Well, in a sense, Amitabha is compassion, or compassion manifest in a humanly recognizable form. As with love, compassion arises in relation to others. Traditionally, compassion is described as a natural response of metta to suffering. On encountering suffering, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas naturally and spontaneously respond with compassion manifesting as a desire to alleviate that suffering. The best way to alleviate suffering, it is said, is to practice the Dharma. And the most compassionate response one can have is to give the gift of the Dharma. Or that is to act in ways that benefit the spiritual growth of others. True compassion, however, like true love, is very rare. Though often spoken of, compassion is something quite mysterious. In a sense, we can't really say a lot about compassion. True compassion is not a mundane worldly emotion, but a transcendental reality. True compassion, or maha compassion as it's sometimes called, maha karuna, is the dynamic counterpart of transcendental wisdom. Wisdom and compassion are two aspects of the same experience. Wisdom is a direct, non-conceptual apprehension of reality. Compassion is its concomitant response. Dante articulates this mysteriousness in a poem called The Unseen Flower. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they did know it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void. I'll read that again. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they did know it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void. So the flower that's associated with Amitabha is the lotus. Amitabha is the head of the Padma family, or the lotus family, and many popular figures are part of this family, such as Avalokiteshvara, Tara, and Padmasambhava. As we know, he sits on a vast red lotus throne. In the figure I described earlier on when we invoked Amitabha, he was in the dhyana, or meditation mudra. Sometimes he appears holding a red lotus in his right hand. And this is the figure that I was introduced to, as Mahatpriya said at the start of the talk. So he holds up a red lotus, which I think he does as an invitation. Amitabha is inviting us to do something. I'll come back to that in a moment. So Gaurava has introduced us to the wall of lotuses when we entered the mandala. The lotus is a common symbol in Buddhism, and it symbolizes transformation and change. It represents the flowering of the potential that resides in all of us. The Buddha said that we all have the potential to blossom into full and perfectly enlightened beings. And just as the lotus grows up out of the mud, from which it derives its nourishment, to rise above the water, firstly forming a tight bud, and gradually unfurling in the sunlight to reveal a beautiful, magnificent flower, so too do we gradually transform our latent potential, nourished by the mud and muck of our own unskillfulness, our greed, hatred and delusion, to rise above them and to unfold in the light of the Dharma, revealing our own beauty and magnificence, revealing our own compassionate natures. The transformation that Amitabha invites us to undergo is a gradual one. It's one of growth and unfoldment. It's a gentle flowering. Another association here with the lotuses that Amitabha suggests, I think, is that the lotus does indeed represent our own flowering and blossoming, but Amitabha also suggests in holding up the lotus that the way in which we bloom is by opening up towards others, by being receptive towards others, by going outwards towards others. How aware are we of the people around us? Often we may live in very close proximity to people and inhabit the same worlds and know very little about them. We can pass around each other rather comfortably, without knowing very much or without going very deep. Here's a few questions. Do you know the colour of your best friend's shirt? What are the colour of your lover's eyes? How does the person you share an office with take their tea? Can you tell when someone who lives in your community is having a difficult time? The first three questions might seem quite small and maybe trivial. But to know them, you'd have to be pretty aware. You have to be pretty attentive and pretty perceptive and probably quite inquisitive. Just in case you're wondering, I answered yes to two of those questions, but I'm not going to tell you which ones. The fourth question is a little bit more serious. Can you tell if someone in your community or someone you know well is having a difficult time? If you can tell, well, the next question is, what's your response? Can you imaginatively identify with their suffering and respond with kindness, metta, friendliness or love? It seems to me that sometimes the people we're actually most aware of are not the ones we like, but the ones that we dislike, the people whom we collide with. I know I'm certainly aware of people that I find irritating and who annoy me and who I'm out of harmony with. It's difficult to ignore these people who are very much around us and among us. And it's usually something quite small that irritates us or annoys us, isn't it? It's the way they cough or they clear their throat. It's the way they eat their dinner, the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they slam the door, or the dreadful, insane music they play all the time. But whenever we're aware of people in this way, we tend to close down. We close up, we turn away, or we even go to war. Once we confront, we immediately polarise. We cease to be in communication. And once we confront, an emotional chasm opens up between us. We create a distance and a separateness. We reinforce and bolster our own egos. In just a second, we can be 1,000 miles apart. On the other hand, every time we open up, every time we reach out, every time we connect, we challenge that ego. We challenge our separateness. We erode our sense of self and we chip away at our separateness. There are thousands of opportunities each day when we have the choice to open up or close down. There are so many opportunities to be generous, so many opportunities to be kindly, to be friendly, to be helpful, to be sensitive, and to be receptive. There are so many opportunities to step out of our miserly, grabbing, stuffy cloister of the ego. From a preoccupation with me, with my interests, and with everything that's mine. And we don't have to do anything particularly grand or fantastic. The things we do can be quite small. Small acts of kindness, friendliness, and generosity go a long way and can have a very big impact on people. Perhaps it's just a smiling acknowledgement or a good morning. A cup of tea, showing an interest, tidying their room or their desk, helping them with their work, doing their washing, or folding their clothes if you take them out of the tumble dryer. I used to live with someone who did that regularly, and it's actually very nice to go to the tumble dryer and find that someone has actually folded up all your clothes nicely. Very small thing, but it's certainly, you feel noticed and cared for. Another one is, if you live in a community, doing small things, like making sure you replace the toilet rolls if you use the last piece of toilet paper. It requires awareness and thought for other people. Maybe it just involves listening, being available, and being present. Sometimes you can physically be with someone, but you're actually miles away. Sometimes you're on another planet, in fact. How attentive are we? You may have noticed what I like to call the coffee shop babe distraction phenomenon. What happens is you go out with a friend to a coffee shop, you sit down, you start talking, and you notice that there's an invisible string attached to your friend's head, and they'll regularly turn that way and come back listening. You don't know necessarily what's going on until it's your turn to listen. And suddenly you find you've lost the thread of the conversation. And you too are turning in various directions. And usually what grabs our attention is a very attractive person. It's usually a babe, in inverted commas. So sometimes we can be with people, but we're actually with other people. We're all over the place. We're not very attentive and not very present. The other side of this is sometimes you can be with someone and they talk at you. They're not at all interested in what you've got to say. They're just there, and suddenly you get this pouring out of words and you get completely drenched. And usually what they're talking about is themselves. Some people, however, are right there. They're with you, they're engaged, they're present, they're attentive and they're aware. And they're usually very mindful. They give you their undivided attention, which is very affirming, but also a little unnerving if you're not used to it. Some of you will have met Bhante Sangharakshita in person, and if you've ever had the opportunity to spend time with him, you notice very quickly that he is right there with you. He is very, very aware of you, very attentive. And the first time I was with him in that situation, I actually found it very unnerving, because I'd never been with someone who was actually there, fully present, and attentive and aware of myself and the other people in the room. When I got used to it, I noticed it's you do feel very affirmed. You do feel, in a sense, nourished and taken in very deeply. So if we're spending time with people, we need to actually be with them as much as we can. Be attentive and be aware. So if you want to open up, you've got to be present. So I think this is not phenomena of receptivity and openness. It connects up with Amitabha's wisdom too. So we've seen that all the jinnas have a particular type of wisdom associated with them. And Amitabha's wisdom is the discriminating or distinguishing wisdom. Whereas Ratnasambhava has the wisdom of equality and sameness, Amitabha sings in all their magnificent, splendid and unique glory. His wisdom notices everything that is particular and different, what sets things apart from each other, the minute differences in things. To distinguish and discriminate, once again, you need to be very aware, you need to take notice, you need to pay attention, and you need to look very closely. And what we will notice if we do pay attention to the world around us is that things and phenomena are constantly changing. Nothing ever stays the same. There's just this continuous flow, this process of change. Everything's in flux. Everything's fluid. So in a sense, everything is unique, because everything is always different from one moment to the next. The central teaching of Buddhism is that all things change. Everything that is conditioned is impermanent. It comes into being and it passes away. And all that comes into being does so in dependence on a whole nexus of conditions, and ceases as those conditions change and pass away. Because of our delusion and our ignorance, we don't see things like this. We see things as permanent, substantial, and satisfactory, when their reality is just the opposite. We see the things the wrong way round, and this leads to suffering. It's only when we have transcendental insight that we see things as they really are. Fixing, clinging, craving, and attaching to what is fluid, what's ever changing, leads us to suffer. For us, impermanence seems painful and frightening. But from Amitabha's perspective, impermanence is delightful and liberating. There isn't anything to hold on to. There aren't any things. There's nothing to cling to. There are no things to get attached to. You can't possess something that's always changing. Seeing things this way involves a profound letting go, a deep relinquishing of our attachments, and the craving that is unfulfillable and insatiable. How energizing and wonderful, how liberating it must be just to free up all the energy that we invest in clinging and attaching to things. So what Amitabha sees is spontaneity. He sees uniqueness and the splendor of each moment. We're a long way from this ourselves, but I think there are moments when we do see things more clearly, when we get a glimpse of the deliciousness of the moment. We get a little closer to reality and we see beauty. And on the occasions when this happens for me, it's usually to do with nature. It's usually when I've been on retreat, when my mind has had a chance to slow down, when the usual noise and clutter settles, when my mind becomes expansive and pliable. Usually when I'm much more aware. I had an experience of this sort of being in the moment recently when I was on a solitary retreat. I was out running, which is something I like to do regularly, and part of the enjoyment of running for me is being out in the open air, being out in nature, and seeing nature all around me. So on this retreat I was running through a woods. It was a fantastic September day. There were clear blue skies all around, the air was very crisp, and there was golden sunlight streaming through the trees. As I was making my way, running through a canopy of trees, I caught sight of a small, pure white feather that seemed to launch itself from the tree, and it slowly began to fall, drifting from side to side. I noticed it drifting as I ran towards it from side to side, and it seemed to be moving at the same pace at which I was running. So every time it drifted across, my feet rose and touched the ground. And it seemed as if our trajectories were destined to meet. And sure enough, just as I ran past it, the feather touched the ground beside me. A few steps later, I felt a huge grin on my face, and I leapt into the air. A huge sense of energy and joy shot through my body. I didn't look back, I just kept running. And I just enjoyed the wonderful moment. A whole series of conditions for that situation to arise would never occur again. It was a unique moment, and it couldn't be repeated. And at that time, I didn't particularly want it to be repeated. It was just enough in itself. Poets are also very good at catching those unique moments, those spontaneous moments, particularly Japanese poets, it seems, with their haiku and waka. They seem to catch these unique moments with amazing brevity, in a sense, the best way one can, using words. So here are two. I think they're waka, actually, not haiku. Here are two of them. Going out to beg this spring day, I stopped to pick violets. Oh, the day is over. Not much to offer you, just a lotus flower floating in a small jar of water. With his all-distinguishing wisdom, Amitabha sees the uniqueness of each phenomenon. Each moment, all the time. Can you imagine how delightful, how joyful that would be? So where does all this love and compassion, this radiant light, this discriminating wisdom stem from? Where does it pour forth from? If we return to the image of Amitabha again, I think we'll find our answer. And it's a slightly paradoxical one. You remember that Amitabha seated on an enormous rich red lotus, resting on a pure white moon mat. His hands are in the Dhyana mudra, the mudra of meditation. One hand rests upon the other, the thumbs lightly touch, and he's perfectly still, in profound concentration. It's from this stillness, this deep, calm, tranquil, peaceful stillness that everything pours forth. All the light, all the love and compassion, the unfoldment of our potential, all the discriminating wisdom, stems from and grows out of this stillness. It comes from the radical, transformative power of meditation. Meditation is one of the most basic and fundamental practices of Buddhism. Perhaps it can be said to be the fundamental practice through which we transform our minds. For the majority of us, meditation is essential. If we're to follow the path, we need to meditate. It's not the only practice, of course, but it's a vital one. And it's through this practice that we systematically transform all the negative and unskillful thoughts. And remember, the thoughts lead to speech and action. All the greed, the hatred, the delusion, the three great poisons, all these are transformed and refined in meditation. Through the practice of the Metta Bhavana, we transform ill will, anger, resentment, hatred, and its manifold manifestations. With the mindfulness of breathing, we calm our turbulent minds and cultivate awareness and mindfulness. Both of these practices are samatha practices that lead to stillness, tranquility and calm. But they're also both practices that can lead to higher states of consciousness. They can lead us into the dhyanas. And as we progress into the dhyanas, these higher states of consciousness, all of our scattered energies, all of our fragmented energies, all our contradictions and our opposites are drawn together and integrated. And when this happens, we experience an enormous sense of expansion, an incredible release of energy as we progressively move through the experiences of rapture and bliss, which leads to equanimity. Here the mind is perfectly still like a vast deep lake. When we enter the dhyanas, we are meditating proper, as it were. The all too familiar hindrances have been left behind and our minds are focused and concentrated. We are in the most positive state we can be this side of enlightenment. We have left the realm of the senses, the karma loka, and entered the deva realm, the realm of the gods. It's a delightful and blissful place to be. We have images of the gods reclining, sort of supping nectar, looking blissed out and delightful. But while the dhyanas are necessary for integration and samatha, they're also quite dangerous. Particularly there's a danger of getting attached to them and getting stuck in them because they're so delightful, which is a disaster. Meditation is not a means in itself, but a means to an end. The aim of meditation is not to have good meditations, is not to be blissful, but to radically transform and change our minds. There's an interesting example of getting stuck in samadhi in the biography of the Chinese monk called Empty Cloud. He seemed to be a particularly good meditator. He lived in a hermitage high in the mountains. And he tells the story of one day he sat down to meditate. And before he did, he thought he would put his porridge on so that it would be ready when he finished his meditation. So he sat down, and when he opened his eyes, the porridge was covered in mould and cobwebs. And it transpired that he'd entered samadhi for 3 months. So he felt delighted about this, and ran to see his teacher, smiling, no doubt expecting a pat on the back. So he said, "Master, Master, I've been in samadhi for 3 months." And his master just gave him an enormous whack round the ear and said, "You stupid fool, why don't you get on with your practice?" No, actually, "You stupid fool, stop messing around, get on with your practice." So higher states of consciousness are also conditional. I'm a bit stuck with empty clouds still, sorry. So when the conditions that lead to arising cease, the states cease too. If we get stuck in the dhyanas, as it were, if we crave or grasp after profound meditative experiences, we can easily lose our way. Perhaps we become a little bit complacent and we slack off a little bit. We may become so absorbed in our inner world and our own experience that we forget about the outer world. We may be so blissed out that we become deaf to the cries of the world. Amitabha's overflowing compassion reminds us that we need to get up off our cushions and take our meditative experience out into the world. To meditate effectively, as we all know, requires a lot of effort and energy, a lot of determination. Even if we don't get into dhyanas, which it seems many of us don't, we know that as soon as we cease to make an effort, as soon as we slack off, we fall backwards. Our progress and transformation slows down. Everybody knows what the effect of missing just one day of meditation is. It takes 2 or 3 days to get back. The image of Amitabha quietly, silently meditating reminds us that we need to keep making effort. We need to keep working with our minds and transforming them. No matter how many times we get distracted, no matter how many times our mind wanders, no matter how many times we find ourselves in a negative mental state, we continually come back to the focus of our attention, the object of our concentration. Every time we do this, we weaken those ingrained habits of our mind. And as we do this, we create new positive habits. We train the mind and our distractions gradually subside. The choppy ways of our mind begin to calm. And peace and tranquility, samatha, begin to emerge. So we're back again at stillness. It's from this stillness, this samatha, when the mind is relaxed, pliable and malleable, and expansive, that we can begin to reflect on the Dharma and the nature of reality. It's from this stillness that insight arises. And as we suggested earlier, meditation is not a means in itself, but a means to an end. That end being an insight into the nature of reality. Once we've established positivity, once we are integrated and happy, healthy and individual, and our mind is calm and tranquil, when we have samatha, we can begin to practice vipassana meditation. Meditation that leads to insight, to seeing things as they really are. Ultimately, of course, it leads to wisdom, the direct non-conceptual apprehension of reality, the truth. And where there is wisdom, there is also compassion. They are one and the same thing. Amitabha, a full and perfectly enlightened Buddha, is the personification of that wisdom manifesting as love and compassion. He is a beacon radiating light, guiding and leading us along the path, responding to our suffering by illuminating the way to liberation. And what he clearly shows us is that the way to liberation is not a selfish endeavour, but on the contrary, a selfless endeavour. He says, how can we be free from suffering when the world around us suffers? In the non-dual state of Amitabha, there's no distinction between self and other. The suffering of others is our own suffering. It's through wisdom that we liberate ourselves, and it's through compassion that we help beings, and all beings, to liberate themselves too. This is everything that Amitabha is. He is the compassionate response to all the world's suffering, and he will continue to radiate until all the world's suffering ceases. So concluding, when we practice the Dharma, when we act selflessly, when we are other-regarding, when we're altruistic, when we show metta, love, kindliness, friendliness, we allow the light of Amitabha to shine through us. And the more we, in inverted commas, that is our self-centered, egotistical, separate self gets out of the way, the more the light can radiate through us. Until ultimately, we too become a beacon for Amitabha's compassionate activity. So I want to end by just reading some verses of praise and homage to Amitabha. In a way, the verses sum up the talk. Om, homage to Amitabha, Buddha of infinite light, jewel of jewels in the Western Quarter, Buddha of unbounded, overflowing, unceasing, unconditional love and compassion. I bow down before you, prostrating many thousands of times, my head at your feet. Om, homage to Amitabha, Buddha of infinite light, beauty beyond beauty's compare. May I always be at your side, always in your presence, bathed and suffused in your ruby light. I surrender all that I have with devoted heart. May you lead and guide me on your path of infinite light. Om. Homage to Amitabha, Buddha of infinite light, Lord of the deathless Samadhi. May I be a beacon through which your compassionate activity radiates. May your love shine through me, and may I never rest or waver until each and every being, barring not one, attains to supreme and perfect enlightenment in the land of bliss, Sukhavati.